Hello and welcome to Casting Nets Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Will Harley. I am joined here with, always, the bald and beautiful Don Winsberger. Don, say hi to everybody.
Hello, everybody.
And we are also joined here with the fabulous family that has been joining us for the last couple of episodes. We have the Hawkmoths here who are with us, Keturah and Phil. Phil, Keturah, why don't you say hi to everybody?
Hi.
Hi.
And they are people of many, many words, as you can see. But we are glad to have them with us again on the show. Before we get into the topic at hand, as we continue to look at this wonderful gift of the interdependence and interrelationship between men and women in the family, church, and in our world, we do want to say a brief disclaimer that everything that we say are just our meanderings and our thoughts, that they are not guaranteed to be the views and opinions of our employers or the views and opinions of the synod in which we are a part, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. But if you have a problem with anything we say, this is a podcast. You can turn it off. If you would like to have a conversation with us, we'd be more than happy to sit down and talk with you. And so without further ado, let us have a little intro music to our topic and get this party started. All right, welcome back. And because this is being recorded on Good Friday, and it is a Friday to be good on, if you are Gandalf and you like Lord of the Rings.
Oh.
Some people have caught it. It's okay. As we have an opportunity to gather on this Good Friday, I thought a good way to begin our time together would be maybe to discuss a question. And the question is, what is your most favorite Easter tradition, Easter ritual, thing that you do with your family that you just do every Easter that you are looking forward to, especially now that we are better at home with the mandates because of COVID?
I'll let the Hawkmoth start.
We're just thinking about that, and you know what? I don't know that we really have like a big Easter tradition. Typically, we'll go to my parents' house in Watertown and spend time with them. But well, that's out the window because you can't go anywhere.
Or we'd go to Michigan.
Or we'd go to Michigan, but once again, out because we can't go anywhere. So, you know, I think the next best thing would be, you know, just an opportunity to go to church, which, you know, we'll still kind of have that opportunity, just not at church. And as far as having any delicious Easter Sunday food, we'll have bacon. So there you go. I'm happy.
Do you not have bacon?
I don't like bacon.
Do you not?
So I did tell him, I said, I'll make it on Easter.
Do you not have bacon on a regular basis? I take it.
No, because she doesn't like bacon or the smell of bacon or anything that has to do with bacon. So maybe once a year.
Okay.
You'll live a lot longer than I do.
Did you think of anything?
What?
Have you thought of anything else then? So.
No, I mean, growing up, my family, with not having family nearby, being a pastor's kid, my dad would take us to the shooting range. I'm not joking.
That would be actually a fun thing to do for Easter.
It was fun. He has risen, and then we'd shoot things. So, you know.
Shooting pop-up targets. He has risen. Bang.
Hey, we'd come home from church, and we'd go shoot stuff. Wow, my family's interesting. Okay.
Phil, that explains so much. Don, what about you? What do you got?
Actually, you know, being single for such a long time, usually it was heading off to my sister's after Easter worship and, you know, getting together, having dinner, and then raiding the Easter baskets of my nieces and nephews. And so, which actually I still do. My daughter, you know, she always gets an Easter basket. And so my challenge or whatever is to find where it is so I can raid hers too. But she's pretty good at hiding hers, so.
Ours aren't so cruel. I don't raid the. I'm not a huge candy person, so I don't raid the Easter baskets of my kids. But my wife does, so I suppose that's all right. We do Easter eggs, so we'll be doing Easter eggs here tonight, and be coloring those, and that's a kind of a neat thing. And then in the morning on Easter, usually after church, we go and we find all the Easter eggs because someone hides them all. And so the kids go run outside and they search around the entire yard and they find all the Easter eggs and they find their Easter baskets and they find all the stuff that goes in the Easter baskets and then they make the baskets. And that's been kind of our tradition that we've sort of done. I remember one time in winter, the dog got out first and found more of the eggs than the kids did and ate them. And all you saw were the pieces of the shells. That didn't go over very well for the dog. But
I know. We plant jelly beans and then lollipops grow.
That is a neat trick.
It is, but it only works on Saturday night before Easter. Well, the lollipops grow from jelly beans.
Okay.
I know.
You know, the Easter bunny hides the eggs. I've never seen him plant lollipops. I've seen him plant other things, you know, as he's running around the yard, but never lollipops.
I was kind of expecting with her family that they would be planting those jelly beans with Tannerite or something like that.
And they explode out of the ground.
Be cool.
Oh, all right. Well, let's get to our topic at hand. A very happy Easter, blessed Easter to all of you who are listening as you are entering and maybe have gone past the Easter season. Jump back on into our discussion on these wonderful interdependent and wonderful relationships we have here with the opposite sex between men and women in the family and in the church. We had sort of brought ourselves to the it's kind of really a bad way to say it, the new concepts that the Synod has sort of put out there for us to understand what or how we should look at the roles for men and women. And the new terms that they're using now or that they're kind of pushing us towards is selfless leading and selfless yielding. Those are kind of the new terms that they're coming out with. Before it was, can you remember some of the terms that have gotten the black ball, Don, that they don't like anymore?
Mutual submission would be one.
Yeah, they don't like submission. They don't like the submission word.
It's not the submission part. It's the mutual one. There's a point when you get into Ephesians chapter 5 and it starts out, at least the NIV translates it, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And that seems to be the focal verse that many want to look at and ignore everything else that gets said after it. And so this mutual submission is more how I like to, I understand it better this way. As when in Ephesians 5:21 there, where it, instead of mutual submission, submitting to one another, it's more of a scattergun approach where we submit to everyone we are to submit to, if that makes any sense.
Sure. Sure. Like if you're in a job and you have someone ahead of you that's supposed to be a higher position, you submit to them, whether you could do their job or do whatever, you follow their lead. Some of the words, though, for our listeners that have sort of gotten a bum deal and a bum rap throughout history here for us, submit, submission, authority, and headship are the terms that...
And obey.
Yep. That are people don't like today. Maybe some of our listeners or know someone or have been someone who cringed at the in the wedding ceremony when they heard some of those words that they had to submit to their spouse or even the term obey them when they were in premarital, and maybe they sort of cringed a little bit at that. Keturah, what about you? Do you like those words?
Yeah, I guess they don't bother me. I don't know. I mean, I have a personality, so I can tell no. I don't know. I guess they don't bother me at all, really. I had some really good role models growing up, my parents, and I don't know, never bothered me, really. Was it supposed to?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a lady. I can't say what would bother me or not. It doesn't bother me.
Some females have an issue with it, sitting in on pre-marriage counseling. I've had a few of them in the course of 30 years. More than a few say, we're not using those words in our wedding vows. And many of them eased up after you go through scripture with them and actually explain what that's talking about, what it's saying, what it's not saying. Sometimes that just helps to clarify things so much too. You know, when it says, notice there, Paul says, wives submit to your husbands, you know, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, all of that stuff there. What it comes down to this is, nowhere does scripture say make someone submit. It never says husbands make your wives submit. That would not be the selfless leading. Okay.
Well, no.
It's not the husband's job to enforce submission, or any leader's job to enforce submission. It is, submission comes from the heart of the one being led.
And notice, you know, you go into Ephesians 5 and notice the type of leading that the husband is called to. I put a lot of weight on husbands, because you have be Christ, right? Be Christ to your wife. Do everything that Christ did for the church. Do that for your wife. And when you do that, what's the natural reaction? I mean, the natural reaction of your wife would be, I'm going to submit to him because he has our best interests at heart all the time.
You know, and look at it this way. Maybe this is a good question to ask, because our society, or at least the English-speaking world in which we live today, has such an issue with it. The term submission is considered to be a profane word. It's considered to be something that means of superiority and inferiority. And it comes back to look at this is something that every Christian believes and professes, that Jesus submitted himself to the will of his heavenly Father. That does not mean Jesus is inferior to the Father. And so me submitting to the president, me submitting to a police officer or anybody else in a position of authority does not mean that I'm inferior to them. And this is where we get some hang-ups and a lot of the hang-ups and misunderstandings and bad attitudes.
For some reason, as you were speaking, the only thing that's playing through my head right now is South Park. Respect my authority.
But you are not condoning watching that program, are you?
I am not. I am not at all. but you were making that comment of, you know, forcing somebody to respect your authority, to forcing somebody to submit, and how you can't really do that. And you know, we have Keturah here, which is a very, very rich blessing for us, because she is a woman of such a character that you couldn't force her to do something. And so, I mean, it's a testament to the selfless yielding, right, of Phil. It's a testament to the selfless yielding of Phil that they work together in this good, wholesome Christian relationship that they have. And I would say, you know, somewhat in part to you too, that the fact that Laura is still with you is a testament to your selfless yielding, selfless leading on your part.
Back at you, brother.
But we go through this just a little bit. What I wanted to do is read a couple of the points that sort of lead into this conversation and then sort of get your responses to some of these points. They are considering these some useful points to keep in mind about selfless leading and selfless yielding. So the first point that's been written for us is all people, male and female, are under God's authority. It's interesting to note that one way to define the sinfulness of human beings by nature is to say that they refuse to recognize the great blessing it is to be under God's authority in their life. All sinners, male and female, are by nature predisposed to look on all authority with skeptical eyes, since our sinful human nature does not trust God. It therefore does not trust him to lead wisely and well. What do you think about that? Nothing. Not a single thing.
I'm listening.
Do you find that to be an appropriate? I guess I never really thought about it. I know we always talk about how our sinful nature and how sin makes us enemies of God, right? Hostile to God. But I thought that was an interesting way of putting it, that really our sinful nature makes us predisposed to have skeptical eyes that God knows what he's doing. But you see that in the garden. You see that with Adam and Eve. God didn't know what he was doing. He missed something vital. So there's information we need to get that he didn't give to us. We could probably see that in our own lives, right? Times when we're getting things pretty hard or getting hit pretty hard with life. And we say, Lord, do you really know what you're doing? Why are you allowing this to happen? I can sort of see the skeptical nature in that. If no other comments, we'll continue on to the second bullet point. Second bullet point is because some try to paint the interdependent and complementary partnership of male and female in the most negative light possible by making it an absurd character of itself, it needs to be stated that every female does not need to consider every adult male to be her God-given authority. Selfless leading and selfless yielding do not function as free-floating abstractions divorced from specific earthly callings and settings. So God designed the principle of the interdependent and complementary partnership of male and female to function in this world wherever men and women partner together in concrete relationships in the midst of their callings in life. They form these relationships to find God-pleasing or God's blessings in these relationships for themselves and others. I'm going to stop there just for a minute. I like what that's saying.
Clarify. Yeah.
From what I'm reading, it's something that I think some of our ladies find very, very hard to contend with sometimes. But what it's saying here is that just because you're a woman or just because you're a male does not mean that you inherently have to yield. If you are a lady, that you automatically have to yield to every guy that you see, and that if you're a guy, that you automatically have authority, or that you're automatically a selfless leader. Does that make sense?
That
what it's saying, that I really think is a very good clarification for our people, for myself, and for our churches and our relationships, is that unless you are in a relationship with them. And I'm not talking about a spousal relationship necessarily all the time, but unless you are in a relationship with them, you're not called to be subservient to them or called to function in this way with them. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I think that is something that at least in the course of 30 years of ministry and looking back when this first came out, this is not something that's new. But it's something that they didn't, that finally they actually, in this study, it's stated and not assumed. if that makes any sense to you, because I think there was a lot of misunderstanding of it in the past with all of this too, that, oh, well, yeah, that, you know, because I remember my mother saying to me about this about 30 years, actually, it was after my father passed away. She said, if you think that one of your dad's brothers is one of your uncles is going to tell me how I'm supposed to handle things right now, she says, you're out of your mind. And I said, nowhere does scripture or the church even hint at that. But my mother, godly and as biblically based as she was, that was an impression that she had.
Oh, and that's what I guess that was what I was saying is I think that's the impression that maybe a lot of ladies in our church have, that just because you're a man in the church, now all of a sudden there's something inherent there that maybe the lady has to give up to interact with them. Does that make sense?
Yes, for me it does, but I don't want to speak for Phil or Keturah.
No, I'd agree with that. I mean, I think there may be some people out there who think that that's the case, that, you know, like you were saying, just because you're a woman, you don't have a say, but that shouldn't be the case. I mean, we're all Christians, and so we should all have that relationship with each other where we can have those conversations and do the things that we need to do as Christians.
And I like how you say we should all have those relationships, because I think that plays in, and please correct me if you think I'm off base on this, but I think that would play into our councils in the necessity for our council members to really have these relationships with, or at least be discussing and talking with, the ladies of our congregation who are especially widows, that our councils should be knowing who they are, be in contact with them, so that they build this understanding of, I am in this capacity as a council member, as an elder, trying to lead with your best interests at heart. But how can you do that unless you know who the people are and know what their interests are, right? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I mean, I guess the picture that kind of popped in my head as you were talking about that is kind of like when you had, you know, in our government, you have representatives, you have senators, right? They're supposed to be there for their people. They're supposed to be there for the people in their district. And so they got to know what the people in their district, how they feel. And so in the same way, wouldn't you say that church council members should also know what the members in their church feel about certain topics, and not just say, hey, this is, I'm the church council member, I have this idea in my head, I'm going to go with it because I like it. What if no one else in the church wants that idea? I mean, is that a fair analogy?
I would say so.
Yeah. Yep.
But I think one of the biggest problems that I have noticed, especially in councils, is that a lot of the members, especially a lot of the widows, don't believe that they have a voice within the council. Because I think half the time, let's just face it, half the time our councils are filled up of people that no one else is going to take the job, so I think I'll just do it. Right? Because no one else wanted to step forward. But I honestly think that maybe some of the ladies in our congregation in this area don't feel that maybe the councils of our churches have their best interests at heart, because there isn't any communication between them. And I'm not saying it's on the council side that they don't, but maybe it's a failing to communicate in all the areas.
Does some of this come from, too? I remember one of the things that was said in the previous Bible study that came out 30 years ago was that there was a blanket statement that was given that these principles apply not only in the church, but also in society. And so there was also an understanding that came from some women, too, that this applied, that it meant that they were to submit to every man out in society as well.
Well, and I don't know if this necessarily leaves that out. It's just not discussed in this section.
It's not discussed in this section, but once again, while these principles apply in the world too, it still stands that a woman is not subject to every man out in society as well.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I definitely would agree with that. I don't want my girls growing up thinking that every guy that they come across is going to be able to boss them around. And I don't think any guy should be bossing them around, but you know what I mean? That sounded really bad.
I look at with Megan, and nobody's going to boss her around. I actually kind of have some pity for the man that the Lord eventually brings her way for a lifetime relationship. So.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
I admire her strong personality and her stubbornness, but I will warn the young man before he puts a ring on her finger.
I don't think she will bring him home to visit you, especially after that time you threw the shotgun shell at the date and told him that it travels a lot faster after 10.
Yep. And it does too. That's scientifically proven. But I digress.
I don't think she'll be bringing anyone home to see you. Well, leading into what you were saying there, and I think it works the other way around. Just like every lady isn't held to be a selfless yielder to every man. One of the second to last bullet points leading into this broader discussion says that God does not entrust all males with specific callings of leadership. Also, all males, almost without exception, will find themselves under the authority of God-given leaders at work, at church, or in government. And so it brings up that idea that just as there isn't a specific order in which that every lady must submit to every man, not every man has authority or has the God-given role for leadership either. Which I thought was a very interesting thing to sort of understand, because sometimes I think we get it in our head that maybe just because we are born male, we have some type of authority, that at least that's been the understanding maybe throughout history. It's changed a little bit, possibly.
You know, you had made an actually profound statements rarely come from your lips, but before the hot moths
pot calling the kettle, right?
And but we're not talking about that right now. But anyway, you said I think a lot of this stuff would be a lot clearer if we as Christians understood vocation better.
And I stand by that statement. It was profound.
And I think, like you said, I think a lot of the confusion that comes from this is that, you know, in our given callings where God has placed us in life, and with the four of us that are here, we all have multiple callings. Okay. Public ministry, spouse, parent, citizen. And the list goes on and on and on. And it's very similar for the people that are sitting in our pews. We don't always understand our own vocations, our own callings, and that's what causes all of this other misunderstanding too, at least a part of it anyway.
Well, and I think even in the ministry, you know, you have the pastor who is called with the most responsibility within the church, right? I'm not going to say that everything flows from him. That's wrong synod. But he's called to have the most responsibility within the church. His call to the church is kind of the broadest. But even he is not there without somebody over him, right?
Yep. But how many times have you had your own congregational leaders, as well as parishioners, come up and say, well, pastor, you're the boss?
But that's not the case.
No, it's not.
It shouldn't be.
And when you say that's not the case, they'll look at you like,
but what are we paying you for?
Yeah. But
well, during COVID, everyone wonders what they're paying us for.
And for, you know, and for good reason, but you know, it, once again, if I think, you know, maybe that'll be a next thing that we do for podcast, is at least spend a little bit of time talking about vocation, which is one of the hallmarks of Lutheranism.
Well, absolutely. You know, Luther praised the father who in his vocation bent down and said the greatest thing that he did as a Christian and as a Christian father was change the diaper of his child. And that's a job he had to do all the time. Phil, you never did that, did you? Did you change the diaper of your child?
I changed a few.
My dad never did, though. In fact, he yelled at me when I made Phil change a diaper once.
Don't worry. Don has never changed a diaper before.
So. That is not true.
Other than his own. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Well, that is not true either.
But I think vocation is something that is interesting because in the light, you know, Keturah, you're a teacher. So at home, you have an interdependence and a wonderful working relationship with Phil that changes when you go to school, right? When you go to school, you have a different relationship with the other teachers and with your principal there. And then you would have at home. And then when you are at home and you're interacting with your children or when you're at school interacting with the kids, that's a totally different type of interaction where you might have children who, you know, try to buck the system or whatever they do. You're the authority, right? You're the authority in the classroom. Whereas outside of the classroom, you know, you don't give up the authority that you practice, but you yield it to someone else who makes greater decisions, right, on behalf of a greater whole. And we sort of do the same thing in St. John. Phil, you're in the school setting, you're kind of the guy that makes some of the greater decisions for the whole. And sometimes you pass them off to the board of ed, and then they pass them off to the board of or the council or the board of elders. But by and large, there's a hierarchy there. And even in the pastorate, the council is supposed to be ruling. And I shouldn't say ruling, but they're supposed to be watching out for the pastor. And the pastor still has a circuit pastor that's above him. And above him, there's the district president. And above them, there's the council of presidents, all of them. I mean, there's always somebody going up the chain that we yield to, right? Selflessly yield to and say, these are people that have sort of bigger responsibilities than I have. Is that a good way to say it or phrase it in the phrasing of responsibilities as opposed to something else?
Keeping in mind that it's something that's in Christian freedom to do things decently and in order, not to confuse any of our listeners that our setup is a lot like Catholic Church hierarchy. It's not set like that. It's a matter of checks and balances to see that things are done decently in order and that the gospel is proclaimed.
Well, now, not only are men sometimes not called to be leaders, but our final bullet point, at least for right now, is women will also find themselves serving in callings as selfless leaders. For example, when entrusted with leadership over other women or over children. Callings in the world where females find themselves in authority over both adult males and females is something for a further discussion. So what do you think about that? What are your comments on understanding that there's sometimes that the ladies are called to leadership positions?
Well, I mean, I guess if you're going from, as far as like a school setting, I mean, I remember at MLC, and I don't know if this is where you're going with that, but you do have women who are teaching the young men at the college to try and get ready for their education, for teaching. So, I mean, in that regard, you do have that. And in some cases, you might have some second career people who might, who are men who might come back and want to become a teacher, and those women are still over them because they have a level of expertise that they're trying to pass on. So there, I mean, it definitely happens. I at this moment can't think of any other examples that'd be worthwhile, but there's a start.
No, I think that's a worthwhile example. What are your thoughts about it though? I mean, to me, I kind of am following what you're saying and saying, you know, it's a recognizing that they have expertise in this area, and there would be foolishness not to submit to one another when someone has an expertise in a certain area to learn from them. It would seem foolish right to me not to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, and maybe being in education, it just kind of just makes sense. You have a teacher, they're teaching you things. They know more than you do. So listen, I don't know.
That reminds me of a conversation I had back when I was in college with one of my buddies that was attending Martin Luther Preparatory School in Prairie du Chien. And he's a senior in high school, and he's 18 years old. And he said the guys were having a discussion about whether it was proper that some of those ladies that were teaching were teaching the 18 year old males, and if that was a violation of authority. And my buddy, who will not be named, and who is a Lutheran pastor in the Wisconsin area, I gave him a hug and I said, "You're a wonderful young man and one of my best friends, but I said, you're an idiot and you need that female leadership."
Yeah, but you can see where some people would look at this and they would say that we are transgressing the principle, right? And maybe it was the way that it was originally stated, that they would look at it and say that the principle that God gives to us from creation is being trampled on when these things happen.
And you got to look at one of these things here too. Does how society views when adulthood begins really, not only maybe in practice, but in theory, have something to do with this too?
So the 35-year-old that lives with their parents is still a child?
You just took away my illustration.
That doesn't give me much hope when my son comes back home.
I was just going to say, I can say this since my daughter doesn't listen to our podcast. That's one of my nightmares.
Well, especially since she's already got her rooms booked in your new building that you're making.
Thank you for reminding me of that too. No, but I mean, really, I think some of this has to do with that. You know, we look at in our society, really even in college, and Phil, you brought up a good illustration that you have some second career guys there. So it's not necessarily a blanket illustration, but how much does our society even view college students really, do we treat them like adults in theory? Maybe I shouldn't be taking us here, and maybe it's irrelevant. My dad was always one that said, and this was back when the voting age was, when the voting age first went over to 18, my dad said your person shouldn't be allowed to vote until you hit the age of 30. And I remember asking Dad why. And he says, because once you get to the age of 30, your brain starts kicking in and says, hey, at least if things have been done right, nobody owes me anything and I want to keep what I want. I want to keep what's mine.
Well, right. I mean, I guess I'd add on to that. When you're in college, I mean, you're still, you're technically an adult.
Your parents most of the time.
Right, right. But I mean, in theory, you're supposed to be an adult because you can vote and you can, you know, do all those other things, but you're still with your parents. Your parents are probably, in some cases, are still helping out with your education, and depending on the family. You depend on your parents so much that really when you're out of college, and in theory, if you are, you get a career and you stick with it, then not decide, hey, I went to 4 years of college, I don't know if I want to do this anymore, I'm going to go back to college. you're on your own. You're like, okay, now what? And at that point, you're once you graduate college, in theory, you should be treated more as an adult, considered an adult. But even then, I think, like you were saying about the 35-year-old living at home, some people, maybe it just takes a little bit longer. Maybe some people don't have the skills to be considered an adult. Ah, that sounds awful, but we're going to go with it.
Well, here's this is interesting. This is a really interesting conversation in the sense of, you know, you go back 100 years, 150 years, and it wasn't unheard of for our ladies to be married 12 to 14, you know, that early age. Even go back as far as ancient times, that was the norm. You know, I talk to the older ladies in winter. You know, if you ever can catch Edna on a lucid moment at the nursing home, she'll tell you how she was married, you know, 16. She was, and that's when she got married and she left and she was out. The thing that I think is interesting though about that is predominantly they were married to much older men. Right. And you know, in the ancient times, you know, 25, 30 was how old the guys were. You know, they, from my understanding of the culture itself, at the age of 30, you were considered to be, old enough to step out of your apprenticeship and into an actual type of a job, of some sort. You know, I'm wondering if there is something that they understood that maybe we don't understand, and that there's something maybe behind some of these concepts that we are glossing over in our own arrogance. And I'm going to use that term loosely, in our own arrogance to try to put a number on when it is that we're an adult and when it is that we want to say we deserve these roles.
Our society right now is tossing that around right now, where there are actually educators in the public school system and in the college system that are saying that our 13 year old and on up should be able to vote. I mean, not to change the subject here, but that came up with the latest mass shooting, where these kids should have a say in their safety and all that stuff.
That's because they're easy to manipulate. I'm sorry.
But I mean, like I said, I don't want to, and yeah, that's part of it. And I don't want to divert this conversation, but I don't think our own society has a grasp on when adulthood really begins. Well, and responsibility.
And that's what I'm trying to say. I mean, there's cultures out there where, well, even in the Jewish culture, I mean, you were free to do pretty much whatever you want as a kid up until 12. Then at 12, you became an apprentice. And you went, all of a sudden that was like the magic number. You moved into a job, whatever that job was going to be that you were going to train to do. That's what you started to do. And you worked at that, and you weren't able to do anything else but work at that until, you know, 25, 30. And then you were considered to be kind of out on your own.
Is there any coincidence that that was about the age when Jesus began his public ministry?
I don't think so. I think he started it at 30 because that's when people would respect him to say he had something to say. In the culture in which he lived, he was respected as someone who could teach now in front of people, and they would listen. So I think there is something to be said there. I mean, there's indication within the scriptures that Joseph was an older man. Mary was far younger than he was. When Jesus is an adult, Mary's still there. Joseph is gone. I think there's something to be said or thought of that maybe what we think is normal isn't really normal. But even going back a little bit further than that, I mean, it wasn't until 1950s that even in our own country, before 1950s, there wasn't a thing called teenagers. They didn't exist. You just had kids and then you had workers. That was it. And then all of a sudden in the 1950s, after World War II and everything, and you start getting this idea of teenagers and kids, this extended period of restlessness that sort of seems to keep extending itself.
That's also, maybe not coincidentally, when affluence started in American society.
I would say so.
After World War II.
Yeah, yeah. It's also when, and during World War II, the ladies went to work. They really, and I'm, okay, I'm fine. Ladies go to work. It's okay. But it was World War II. The ladies went, they left the homes, right? You saw the shift. They left the homes. The men were in war. The ladies left the homes. They went to work, and they said, we like it here. And so now the homes were empty, and the kids were kind of left to their own devices. And then maybe I don't know. There was you see the shift, though. After the war, you saw the shift. And we started to shift in this way where we had this extended period of childhood. And they just kind of lose their mind. You get into the 60s and the 70s, and they're nuts. And they are. And then they kind of bounce back a little bit. And maybe some of the youth of today are looking for more structure, and they're looking for more stability than youth of previous times. But I think there's something to be said here that we're talking about these roles of men and women, and for one, in the house, you hardly find them anymore. So let's just start there. Broken homes makes it very difficult to see selfless leading and selfless yielding played out. It makes it very difficult when you have a broken home. But even in homes that are intact, you have mom and dad coming home and they're tired, right? And so many couples live as roommates instead of as spouses. And these are the examples that these kids are getting. And then they're enforced to you know, their parents are their best friends. They're not their parents. And there is encouragement to just kind of be a kid and to always kind of be a kid. And don't worry, mom and dad will fix it for you, because you know, that only seems right that we fix it for you. Does this play into this at all? In our lack of understanding how this should work?
Well, you know, maybe looking back on a few things, drawing back to you took us back to how things in Jesus' day and things in Bible times and maybe relating it to scripture a little bit. Did they have a better grasp on things, or was it something that was just purely cultural?
I don't know. Maybe the culture reflected their knowledge.
And a lot of times it does, or lack of it.
There you go. And does our culture reflect our lack of knowledge?
That's a whole other podcast, isn't it?
Okay. Well, didn't they kind of uphold women a little bit better than maybe we do today? I don't know. I mean, like, you look back to when, like, my grandparents were younger or whatever, it just seems like women were just treated nicer. Like, they held doors open and they thought they were just amazingly beautiful, and just I don't know how to explain it with what my brain is saying. But now it's kind of like, you know, guys don't hold doors open, or they, you know, they just, they're, women aren't, you know, like, I'm not saying treat me like, okay, I am saying Phil, treat me like a princess, I'd be okay with that. But you see a lot of women not wanting basically for men to do that, so then they just kind of stopped.
Well, and I think that's interesting, and I agree with you. I actually agree with you 100% that we've hit a stage in our society's development that we've, I think, taken, instead of steps forward like we've wanted to, we've taken more steps back, in the sense that there were some things, and maybe I should just slow down here just so I don't get myself in trouble in what I'm saying. There were some things that needed to change in the way that we dealt with the sexes in our society. There were some things that needed to change. you know, the ability for women to advance in profession, the ability for them to get paid for the same jobs. I understand that. There, I am not. I think that's fine. The ability to recognize women's gifts and skills that God has given to them, those are needed things. But I think you're 100% correct. In our pursuit for those things, we said women are just the same as men. And I think you're right in what you're seeing, which in the way I interpret it is, if they're the same as me, I'm going to treat them like I treat any other guy.
Right. Right. Like, I mean, years ago, you would never be in, like, I mean, when I was in high school and college, boys would make horrible smells in front of girls and think it's okay. But before that, how they would never do that. You know, I mean, if you're going to impress the girl, you're not going to impress her that way. Just saying. Like, go do it someplace else. I mean, you want to be on your best behavior around a girl you like, not a slob and disgusting.
My sister is not part of this podcast.
I mean, you don't, I don't know. I mean, if my son would ever do that, I would just be appalled because, I don't know, you want to respect her and hold her up, not treat her like your buddy and say, smell this. I don't know.
Well, but you know, there's something to be, there is something to be said that, you know, men should place, especially the important women of their life on a pedestal, right? That's kind of what Ephesians 5 is saying, that they're giving up everything for them to make them clean and holy, right? And present them as clean and holy. That's kind of putting them on a pedestal. And that's sort of what you're saying. That's sort of the idea of you know, there should be something special in the way that we're treating them that we're not doing. And there should be not demeaningly special, not saying like we're treating them like the short bus type of special,
right?
But that we're recognizing that we are created different in many ways, and that there is something to respect about that. And I think that's a good conversation to have, because I think it goes into vocation, that flows itself into vocation. It flows itself into communication, which are all topics that we've talked about. It also flows itself back into the conversation at hand, which is selfless yielding and selfless leading. You know, how can you be a selfless leader if you're only thinking about yourself? And how can you be a selfless yielder when you're too concerned about how are they treating me? Right?
Right. Well, I mean, I would be more receptive, like, I mean, my principal is not this way, but I mean, if I had a principal in my, or a teacher in my school that was a male and he was constantly telling these disgusting jokes all the time, I wouldn't want to do things for him. You know, I would be like, no, you have to do your own recess duty because I don't like your jokes. I mean, it's, I don't know if I'm making sense.
Keturah, doesn't some of that filter, some of that filtered its way out into society already when you look at, a lot of that behavior is considered to be harassment.
Well, yeah, but I mean, yeah, even if you look in the society too, I mean, I people watch, maybe I shouldn't, but it's kind of fun to do. And I'll even see, you know, younger couples if they're dating or whatever. And, you know, the guy will be totally rude to this girl, you know, might kind of make fun of her or something or call her a name. And she still goes with him and it's just, or she still likes him. And I mean, if Phil would ever call me a name that's inappropriate, I would not stand for that. He never has. But I mean, just this, like one time
Phil.
I saw a guy kind of like shove his girl around and say she was fat. I'm like, no way, you don't treat someone like that. Like, why do you go back to him? I don't.
Well,
but you see that everywhere.
We were in Chicago, and this is right before Don had gotten there. For our meeting down in Chicago a couple months ago. And in Chicago, I'm sitting there. I went out to eat, just to grab a bite to eat, and I'm sitting there just sort of people watching, like you said. And a couple comes into the restaurant, and she is dolled up to the nines. I mean, she was treating this like a date night. And the guy that she was with, I swear, she used a spatula and picked him up off the street. And
right.
And she was buying and paying for everything, and he was just a bum. And my first thought was, is this what we've worked so hard to obtain?
Right.
Is this really what the men want to be for their ladies? And is this really what the ladies want their men to be? That was the first thing that came to my mind. Well, second thing that came to my mind. The first thing that came to my mind was, wow, he's horrible.
How did he get her?
there's a song like that. There's a song about that from the 1970s. Can't remember who the musician is, but is she really going out with him?
But it makes you kind of wonder, though. I mean, if this is this is a very timely topic for us to be talking about as we are dealing with our family and we're dealing with how we work in a church, because the church itself should be countercultural. And so maybe with our youth in our church and our males in our church, we should still be upholding, we're going to treat women the way that they should be treated, and we're going to give them the respect that is due them. And even in the wells where we say, okay, they don't vote, but I'm going to take their interests to heart, and I'm going to take time to find out what those are so that we can do these things out of respect for them, because they deserve respect too. Maybe that's the countercultural thing that the church should be doing, right?
And as a female, I mean, if a man would treat me that way, I would do my best to do what I can to help him out. You know, I mean, it's, you know, dual, I guess. I don't know. I mean, like, if Pastor, if you would treat me like scum, basically, I would probably ignore you. You know, but you don't. You totally don't. I'm just saying.
Phew.
It's goes hand in hand. I mean, you're gonna treat me the way I should be treated. I'm gonna do the same thing for you. If you're gonna badmouth me, well, then I'm done. You know. I don't know.
But no,
and you know, submission does not mean, or you know, these roles do not mean inferiority, not being vocal, and not being a strong person. You know, I look at. As we've been talking, I think of an example from the Gospel of John. I think it's in John, where John and James' mother, Salome, comes to Jesus and with a pretty bold request, Lord, give my sons a throne on each side of you in the kingdom.
Just before you continue your story, let me ask you one important question: were they adults? Just asking.
Well, you know, and you know, there you go. I mean, you know, and who knows? I don't know. Did the brothers put their mom up to it, or was it just something of her? But I do think, you know, here's a, and of course she's related to Jesus. She's, if I'm not mistaken, wouldn't she have been an aunt?
Yeah, cousin, or something like that.
An aunt, or at least a first cousin, or second cousin, something like that. But really, she would still looking at the same thing, maybe a little bit of an authority figure for Jesus yet too in the family, an elder, whatever. But you know what? She's pretty bold. And nothing wrong. I do not use that in a negative term. But she asserts herself. I don't think her assertion was in any way wrong, or her approach with Jesus, her idea was idiotic, but not her approach and her role.
I think you could say the same thing with Jesus's mother at the wedding of Cana. You could say the same thing with Mary and Martha. The first time when Martha complains that, you know, Mary's not helping, and the second and third time when both of the ladies come up and say, Jesus, if you would have been here, they all take assertive roles and claim, Jesus, I have a right to come to talk with you. But in the end, you know, like Martha says, even, you know, leading up to the raising of Lazarus, I know that whatever you ask for will be done. I know that this is going to happen. So maybe there's a joint, wonderful segue into that of saying that, yeah, you know, there's, sharing your opinions, being assertive and saying, you know, these are things that I need too, and letting those things be known aren't wrong or bad or horrible. They're wonderful as long as we do them in the vein and in the right way that we look at it and say, okay, but the final decision isn't going to rest on me and my wants. It's going to be resting on what is best for all as we move together.
And that's what I think Professor John Brugge was saying 30 years ago in the initial study. He termed it a spirit of submission. A spirit or an attitude of submission. It all starts in the heart. And, it, you know, doesn't Jesus teach us that too? Our behavior, it proceeds from the heart. If it is a godly heart, if it's a heart moved by the Spirit, it's going to be good fruit. If it's a heart moved by sin, it's going to be bad fruit.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's where our sinful nature sort of kicks us, right? Because not everything that comes from my heart is as good as I want it to be.
And I think it's hard. I mean, I feel bad for, you know, men on this one, especially if they have family and, you know, you carry the brunt of it all. I mean, for example, I'm going off of a called worker here, but when you do have calls, you have to, you know what you want to do, but you also have to think of your family. And okay, if Phil would have a call, I would voice my opinion often and it would probably drive him crazy because he knows that if he'd ever get called to Arizona, I'd really want to go because I love heat. And even though if it's not right for us, I mean, having him deal with how he knows I feel and everything else, I mean, that's got to be really hard on you guys because you are listening to our suggestions and our thoughts, and it's got to just be crushing sometimes. And I'm really sorry for whatever I do to you, Bill.
Well, take it from a guy.
That's not, I mean, I don't want to speak for Phil, but I'm going to speak for myself here. You need to talk to my bride sometime, Keturah, because she is from Arizona, and I know that it's the same thing if I'd ever get a call there, although I'm to the point to where I'm fed up with winters as well. But it's one of those things in considering it, you know, in the fact since we've been married, I have had the opportunity to weigh out a call. Considering her, and even in the last call I had, considering my daughter and where she was at her in her point of life, that wasn't a burden. It's because when you love somebody, that's just something that comes natural.
And take it from a guy who had just accepted a call within the last 3 months. I remember plain as day sitting in the living room with my wife and saying, if you don't want to do this, whether I think it's for the best or not, we won't do this. Because if it wasn't going to work with her, you know, that wasn't going to work with me. And I remember the tears, I remember the crying, and I remember the working it out together, saying, whether I like it or not, this is the best for the family. Not just for me, not just for her, you know, because I'm sure there were choices she could have said, I'm comfortable here, I could stay because I'm comfortable here, but it would benefit the family. I could go, I could stay. Would it be best? What would benefit the family? And eventually, you know, you come together. And this is the beauty of, I think this is the beauty of what we're trying to say here with this principle, is we work together for the betterment of this wonderful blessing of family that God has given to us as we work it out. As called workers, as people, as couples, members in the church, it becomes a messy deal because we always go back to the principle, and we can't say there's a hard and fast rule of, okay, gentlemen, there's no farting in front of your no farting in front of the girl you like because that's can't go there. You know, we love those hard and fast rules. I mean. But it's better to go back to the principle and to teach the principle and then have our children hopefully learn something that says, I probably shouldn't do that because it's not really a respectful thing for anybody, but especially for the lady that I'm kind of interested in. Maybe to learn the principle and then to keep applying it every time they reach something else. Well, that brings us, I would say, unless you have other comments, to the end of maybe a really good discussion today. Next week, final week on this discussion is, how are we going to deal with this in a world that doesn't believe the same thing? And that's really where we're going to go next week. So if you, Phil, Keturah, if you're willing to join us for one more week, I mean.
Think we can do that.
All right. Anything else that any of you would like to say to take us out?
Wish you would have practiced what you preached when we first started rooming together at conferences.
You're not a girl.
Thank you.
With that, God's richest blessings. Have a happy holiday season as you celebrate the resurrection, and a happy Good Friday if you listen to this early.